been 5 years since Michael Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. Within days, Ferguson was flooded with reporters from all across the world, including me. At the time, I was part of a New York Times team that was dispatched to the scene. I'll never forget driving onto West Florissant Avenue, where protesters gathered day and night, and seeing armored trucks, law enforcement dressed in fatigues and battle gear, and being pelted with tear gas. I can't forget the image of people running through the thick clouds of smoke, knocking on the door of the McDonald's, and trying to get something, anything, to pour in their eyes just to calm the sting of the tear gas. Wesley Lowery of the Washington Post was there too, but he stayed much longer, spending 4 months on and off in Ferguson, covering what quickly became a national conversation on race and police brutality. And Wesley's with me now to talk about what he experienced and the role of media in shaping the aftermath of Brown's death. He's a national correspondent for the Washington Post. Wesley, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Aaron Morrison, a senior reporter for The Appeal, who spent time in Ferguson 6 months later. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
I remember the first time I saw anything about Michael Brown was on Twitter, and it was the photo of his body on Canefield Drive. Wesley, what was your first memory? When did you first hear about Michael Brown? And from that point to being on the ground in Ferguson, tell us what happened there.
Sure. And so it certainly was that first day, August 9th, the photo of Michael Brown's body on the ground, many of the tweets from St. Louis, from Ferguson that day. At the time, I was in Michigan. I was covering a congressional race in suburban Detroit, but I was following the local coverage. And by the time I got back to D.C. that following Monday, there had now been two or three nights of protest, of anger, still very few answered questions. And by that evening, I was on a plane to Ferguson, got there Monday evening, August 11th.
Aaron, you were a reporter in New Jersey at the time. Mm-hmm. When did you hear about Michael Brown's death, and what was the reaction where you were in communities outside of Ferguson in New Jersey?
The same way that most people learned about it, I saw it on social media, and I was at a paper covering hyper-local news. And so I found a way to localize the story. Okay, what's happened here recently that people, you know, might be interested in revisiting as we're starting to have a new conversation about police brutality in this country?
I got to Ferguson, Wesley, probably about a week after you were there, and I was there for 8 days, so I don't want to make this some sort of martyr thing that I did, but I was sent out, the New York Times, part of a larger New York Times team, and the first things I recall are the heat, driving right to a police press conference where you and other folks were there, and this sort of lingering tension in the air. When you finally got to Ferguson, what were your feelings? What did you remember?
You got to imagine, and those of us who've been there know, right? Canfield Drive is a set of apartment buildings that's kind of down a side street. Michael Brown had been killed in the middle of the street, his body laid out there for hours. And so you had hundreds of people who were looking out their window of their home and seeing the body of a teenager. And no one was answering any questions for them. And meanwhile, every single night, there were hundreds of people showing up in protest. And so every night, you had the standoff between the citizens and the police. And more nights than not, it ended in chaos.
Aaron, when you got to Ferguson, when did you get there? And what were your first scenes? Like, what was this feeling like on the ground?
So I went to Ferguson roughly 6 months after the first uprising. And what I found, things hadn't been completely covered up. The quick trip was still fenced off and it was still burned. There were still signs of what had happened, what I'd only seen, you know, from far away.
Wesley, how were you received by the police and law enforcement more broadly? And how were you, what was your relationship like with protesters?
So I think that there was certainly among the police a frustration with the media. I think that a lot of the powers that be in Greater St. Louis, not just the police, but a lot of the political establishment, some of the statewide elected officials, thought that the media and the national media were somehow the problem. The news is missing it. Nothing is true. This is all wrong. It's all made up, right? Now, that is obviously wasn't the case, right? That the national media came in and told a bunch of stories of local residents that had not been being told otherwise. And ultimately, the Department of Justice concluded that these complaints of the demonstrators and the protesters were true. They were correct, that the police were systemically abusing people here in Ferguson and in St. Louis County. But the relationship with the police was extremely tense. And frankly, it's supposed to be that way to some extent, right? We're trying to get answers from our government. But that said, on many nights of the protests, there were clear and obvious kind of First Amendment violations, right? Journalists being arrested for trying to do their jobs, being threatened, well, if you don't move this way, we're going to shoot tear gas at you. There was video footage of police officers disassembling camera equipment or moving aggressively at members of the media. The protesters also kind of had mixed feelings about the media. And understandable, right? Here we had all come and shown up in this place, and they were frustrated. Sometimes they thought the media coverage wasn't fair, or they thought their quotes were being chopped and screwed and not used in fair ways, or they thought we were missing the bigger story. And so there were definitely moments of real tension. I think all of us who spent a lot of time there had people who welcomed us with open arms and other people who were like, you guys should get out of here.
And Aaron, when you got there 6 months after, was there a different feeling about you being a member of the press? Were the police more open? Were residents more open? Or was there wariness?
I saw both of those things. I saw people who were tired of the dozens of news trucks being parked everywhere. But at the same time, I was welcomed by people who, once you told them what you were trying to do, what you were trying to uncover, or what you were trying to amplify, they were willing to speak. They were willing to speak because they wanted to show multiple sides to their community. Everyone had seen the unrest, but few people had seen Ferguson when it experienced some calm. And so that's what I was able to show as people prepared for the election, as people were going around and canvassing neighborhoods to get, you know, votes for the city council. I visited a school where students and teachers were having conversations about what had taken place in their city. There was a confirmation, I think, that what had been reported by folks that were there early on really was what it was. Like, it there was not some, you know, conspiracy by the media to make this, fake news moment, which I was refreshing. Because I was like, okay, now I'm going to build on what, my peers have already done here.
You're both Black male reporters. Did you feel that folks in Ferguson were more likely to speak to you?
Yes, unquestionably. I thought that it wasn't even just being a Black reporter, it was also being a young Black reporter, that many of the people in the streets were young people, were teenagers, were college-age students. Many of the young activists were in their early 20s, and I was a young Black reporter in my early 20s. I think that one of the things we know about being journalists, about being reporters, is that it's our job to talk to people and convince people to tell us things. And it's about building relationships. And each one of us are who we are as a person, our backgrounds, our family trees and social connections help us build relationships. There are some doors that I might knock on that I'll get them slammed in my face while another colleague will get it opened, and vice versa. And so as it became increasingly important that these stories of Black Americans, many of them poor or low income, who had felt like they'd been abused by the police and abused by the government, as that became one of the chief domestic storylines in the country, it was extremely important that newsrooms employed people who could engender the trust of the folks closest to those stories. And more often than not, that was reporters who looked like the three of us.
Right. And I could add to that. I experienced going to a church, a Black church, where the pastor told me up front, like, I've turned down so many reporters, but the moment I told him that my family was also in the Church of God in Christ, he gave me access immediately to members of his congregation who did still, you know, want to speak about their experience, and not just their experience during the uprising, but their experience since the 80s and the 70s in this community, where this used to be a majority white community that flipped and became a majority Black community, but the city government never became majority Black. And so there were all sorts of implications for police. So that was my way in, was embracing family history and identity to gain access and be able to tell a thorough story.
Wesley, just to wrap up, have we, as the media, gotten better at covering this topic and topics related to the killing of Black and brown Americans by police?
Yes and no. To the extent to which this topic is covering police-involved shootings specifically, I think the answer is yes. I think that these cases showed why it's important for us to be skeptical of power and skeptical of government and not just believe everything the police says. But to the extent to which this issue is race in America, I think the ongoing coverage of the current president, of his campaign, of his rhetoric, shows the extent to which the media is still not completely equipped and completely ready to tell these stories. And a big part of that is because we all love our colleagues, we love our newsrooms, but we know that our newsrooms still do not represent the diversity and the complexity of the country that we cover. That the vast majority of people writing these stories, assigning these stories, editing the audio, directing the coverage are middle-class white people. And because of that, our media collectively has a deep blind spot as it relates to issues of race and very often does not have the proper skepticism or the proper perspective on how issues of power, issues of disparity, and issues of injustice work. And so there's still a long way to go, but I'm really glad to have colleagues like you and Aaron, who I know are working hard on this type of stuff too.
And we'll end on that note. Wesley Lowery is the national correspondent for The Washington Post, and Aaron Morrison is senior reporter for The Appeal. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No peace!
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.